One, just honor you, glorify, worship you, exalt you. Father, what a blessing as you declare in your word that you inhabit the praises of your people. That's who you are. That's what you do. Father, as you met with us in worship, meet us now. Give your word that which you declare to be power. Power to transform, power to renew. You would instruct us where we need to be instructed. You would exhort us where we need to be exhorted, Lord. But in all ways, draw us into a place that's closer to you. A place of dependence upon you. Intimacy with you. So simply give us ears to hear what your Spirit would speak to us, your children, here tonight. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, saints, tonight, as we go through the book of Psalms, we find ourselves in Psalm 60 through Psalm 64. That's our journey here for tonight. As I shared last week, the grouping of this psalm, we're looking at the theology of the cycle of struggles. So if you want a note for tonight's message, it's as we're going through these groupings of psalms in their theology, we're looking at the theology of the cycles of struggles. And so keep in mind that through Scripture, God talks about certain cycles that goes on. If you're familiar with the book of Judges, there's a thing called the sin cycle. That eventually what happens is the people of Israel are finding themselves in peace. As they find themselves there in peace, then they begin to just simply drift away from seeking the Lord because everything's good, everything's at peace, everything's fine. And so they find themselves drifting away. Well, when they drift away, then God does this. He brings about situations where all of a sudden they're not so comfortable anymore. Now they're at a place where we have to cry out to God once again. And as they cry out to God, then God just wonderfully sends a deliverer. The deliverer takes care of the situation, and they find themselves at peace. After they find themselves at peace, what do? They begin to drift away. And the same cycle happens over and over again. But what we're looking at in the theology of the cycle of struggles is kind of the same thing as you see in Judges, but deeper because you find yourselves here in the book of Psalms, the book of worship. Initially, what we're going to see is this. In Psalm 60, we're going to see basically the struggles. That's what we're going to be looking at initially, where God's going to allow the struggles in the lives of his children, and he's going to bring them to the truth so that they recognize one thing. There is no security in anything but you. That's it. The only thing I can trust in is you, nothing else. And so he allows struggles in our lives so that we no longer think that we can do something, no longer that we trust in other things, but we only trust in God. And so, amazingly, what we see in verse 4 of Psalm 60 says this, "You have given a banner to those who fear you, that it may be displayed because of the truth." The banner, if you're familiar with it, it's a flag that's used for battle. It's a flag that's used for armies. And a banner is a rallying point. So when God makes a statement, he says, I've given you a banner. You've given a banner to those who fear you. You are that banner. You are the rallying point. Everybody runs to you. And I think that's the key of what we're looking at. Basically, as we look to the struggles that David will be facing, he runs to God. The next thing that we see is this. As we get into Psalm 61, we're going to be looking at the seeking and the supplication. And so we're going to see here, we're in the verse 1, "Hear my cry, O God, and tend unto my prayer. From the end of the earth I will cry to you when my heart is overwhelmed. Lead me to the rock that is higher than I." Sounds familiar. I know it does, but as we're going through this, that's the key. It's the seeking and the supplication. Because in the times of struggles, once God allows struggles into your life, the soul does what? I got to go to the only place that's safe. The soul cries out to God. And so that's what we're going to see here in the seeking and the supplication, seeking God, crying out to God, when we do find ourselves in trouble, when we are overwhelmed. Then, as we get into Psalm 62, we're going to see the solo satisfaction of his shelter. As we look at Psalm 62, what we're going to see is this. Uniquely, it begins this, "Truly, my soul waits for God, for from him comes my salvation. And then it uses these words, he only. As we go through that psalm, we're going to see that he only and God alone is used again and again and again. So what we're recognizing here is this solo satisfaction in him. Just you only, you only, you only, God alone, nothing else. And so it singles everything down. Nothing else is visible but what? God. Nothing else is sought after but God. And so I love the fact that when you start with the struggles, you come to God as a rallying point, and then you realize this, I don't want anything else around you. I don't want anything else to distract me from. I only want you. And so I love the fact that as we go through these cycles of struggles, we start off with the struggle. God brings them into our life, that we begin to seek him. Then we recognize that we just look to God. And as we do that, when we're overwhelmed, he's the one that we look to. But then we do what? We let everything else go. We only focus on the Lord. And then when we only focus on the Lord, then Psalm 63 comes into play, because we see here the savor of the spiritual satisfaction. This is where you have a deep, deep communion with God, where he says in Psalm 63, verse 1, God, you are my God. Early will I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh longs for you. And so we recognize there's this deep, deep seeking, a communion that you want with God. And then as we hit Psalm 64, we're going to see the secured victory. In verses, 7 through 10, it says, but God shall shoot at them with an arrow. Suddenly they shall be wounded. So he shall make them stumble over their own tongue. And so it's just interesting that we begin to see that when it comes to the secured victory, that basically God is the only one that secures the victory. It isn't anything that we do. God does it alone. So that's what we're looking at as we go through this theology of the cycle of struggles. Let's jump into the first one in Psalm 60. And it begins this, and I want you to understand that when the scriptures, as in the Psalms, your Bible should have what's known as a header. It should have something that prior to verse 1. So if you take a look at Psalm 60, your Bible should say this, to the chief musician, set to Lily of the Testimony, a miktam of David, for teaching when he fought against Mesopotamia and Syria of Zobah, and Joab returned and killed 12,000 Edomites in the Valley of Salt. You should have that somewhere in your Bible. You should have that header. It's important to recognize that what we see is this, those headers mean something. Sometimes it's just simply a Psalm of David, that's all he wants you to know. But this is specific. And as we take a look at this, what happens is we're beginning to see that within this Psalm, and I want you to understand that because of the header, we recognize something important, that David himself is fighting multiple battles on different fronts. So as we're looking at this, it talks about he fought against Mesopotamia and Syria of Zobah, and Joab returned and killed 12,000 Edomites. This is a reference to 2 Samuel chapter 8. And if you would, please turn there in your Bible, 2 Samuel chapter 8. I'm going to start reading in verse 1, and then I'm going to read down through verse 6. So you can understand what the situation is the Holy Spirit has spoken to David to write about in this psalm. Because the psalm is going to make so much more sense if you bring it into its context. In 2 Samuel chapter 8, verse 1, after this it came to pass that David attacked the Philistines and subdued them. Metheg, Ammah, from the hand of the Philistines. And then, verse 2, he defeated Moab, forcing them down to the ground. And he measured them off with a line. With two lines he measured off those to be put to death, and with one full line those to be kept alive. So the Moabites became David's servants and brought tribute. Now verse 3. David also defeated Hadadzer, the son of Rehob, king of Zobah, as he went to recover his territory at the river Euphrates. And David took from him 1,000 chariots, 700 horsemen, and 20,000 foot soldiers. Also, David hamstrung all the chariot horses, except that he spared enough of them that for 100 chariots. Verse 5, then the Syrians of Damascus came to help Hadadezer, king of Zobah. David killed 22,000 of the Syrians. Then David put garrisons in Syria of Damascus, and the Syrians became David's servants and brought a tribute. So the Lord preserved David where he went. So understand, what we've read is this. Verse 1, he went and attacked there to the west. He attacked the Philistines. After that, in verse 2, then he goes and he attacks to the east. He attacks Moab. And then he goes to the north. And he begins to attack both Mesopotamia. And as he's attacking Mesopotamia, Syria, the king of Syria, comes and helps out Mesopotamia. Now, what's not stated here in 2 Samuel is this, and it's only stated in the header of Psalm 60, that while you have Mesopotamia, now keep in mind that Mesopotamia and Syria are like an upside down V. On the western side, you have Syria, and then Syria comes and joins at the tip of the roof to what? To the eastern side, Mesopotamia, and those two countries literally they form like an upside down V. They form a roof and they meet there in the top part of it. So you've got west and east, you got Syria, Mesopotamia, and then you have the meeting. So when David is going to attack Mesopotamia, now Syria comes and joins in on the battle. Now, what we recognize according to, you know, 2 Samuel chapter 8 is very simply that what? It looks like, yeah, David had a great victory. But what it doesn't share is this, that in the middle of that battle, when the Syrians came to help out Mesopotamia, that Joab had to leave. Joab had to leave the battle. He had to go down south because take a look at the header. Joab returned and killed 12,000 Edomites in the Valley of Salt. So he's going all the way to the southern part of Israel, not northern up by the top part of Syria. He literally has to travel about 150 miles on foot to go and to do what? To fight another battlefront. So it looks like David has been victorious. He's taken on the Philistines. He's taken on the Moabites. He's taken on Mesopotamia. He's taken on Syria. And it looks like it's always a victory. But what Psalm 60 says is this. There was a moment, there was a time in these battles when David was conquering that all of a sudden something radical happened. David begins to literally, he's like, Lord, what's happening here? I'm losing. Joab has left. Now understand that as he leaves, he's taking enough of the army to literally come against 12,000 Edomites. David here has been victorious against the Philistines, victorious against Moab, and now he has been victorious against the Mesopotamians. But now Assyria comes, Joab takes part of the army, and David himself now begins to lose. That's what Psalm 60 begins to show. So let's look at this as far as that, where we begin to see that David is now going from a place within this battle that he's been victorious and victorious, and all of a sudden, he's not anymore. Do you understand that when you are successful again and again and again and again, that you sometimes take on the false belief that what? I am successful. I am really good. And God has a way, he has a beautiful way of letting us know that what? The battle's the Lord's. It is not you. It is me, and it is only me. And so keep in mind that what we recognize here is that David is being stretched thin. Now, within this stretching, within Syria coming now to help out Mesopotamia, Joab having to leave, there's a season now, a moment of time, we don't know how long it is, where David begins to lose. And he makes this statement. As he's battling this battle, as Joab moves south with a part of the army, David is now fighting both Mesopotamia and Syria. He says this in verse 1. God, you have cast us off. You have broken us down. You have been displeased. Oh, restore us again. You have made the earth tremble. You have broken it. Heal its breaches, for it is shaking. You have shown your people hard things, and you've made us drink the wine of confusion. It's interesting that David begins to, as he's experiencing defeat, he has a spiritual epiphany, recognizing that this defeat is God. This defeat is God giving David a wake-up call. That if you're going to be victorious, but don't think that you are going to be victorious. You are going to have victory in me and in me alone. And so what he does is he basically brings David to this point of, listen, you have to understand that you are being disciplined. There's a passage, if you guys know it, just jot it down for you note takers, found the book of Hebrews chapter 12. I want to read a couple of verses to you. I want to start reading in verse 5, and I'm going to read down to verse 12. He says this, "And you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as to sons. My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens and scourges every son whom he receives. If you endure chastening, God deals with you as sons. For what son is there for whom a father does not chasten? But you, if you are without chastening, of which you've all become partakers, then you are illegitimate and not sons." Verse 9, "Furthermore, we've had human fathers who corrected us, and we paid them respect. Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? For they indeed for a few days chastened us to seem best to them, but he for our profit, that we may be partakers of his holiness. No chastening seems joyful for the present, but painful. Nevertheless, afterwards it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Therefore, strengthen the hands which hang down and the feeble knees." So the chastening doesn't weaken us. The chastening strengthens us because it does what? Brings us to an end of ourselves and brings us back to trusting in God. And so as we see here in the first three verses of Psalm 60, David is just asking, what's going on, Lord? We're being stretched so thin, and yet he recognizes that God has allowed this. And the reason he allows it, David kind of gives an answer at the end of Psalm 60 in verse 11 and 12. He makes this statement, and let me read it to you. "Give us help from trouble, for the help of man is useless. My army, I don't care how big they are, I don't care how trained they are. I understand one thing. The help of man is useless. Through God, we will do valiantly." Do you understand? It isn't about the manpower. It isn't about all these things. Lord, it's about you. So what God does is this. As David has been victorious and victorious, something happened where David recognized that God is now chastening him. Something was going on in David's mind and David's heart where God had to say, listen, David, you cannot trust in you. You cannot trust in your army. You have to come back to me. And so that's what he does. Here are the first three verses. He asks, what's going on? What's going on? But then you go to verse 4 and 5, what do you see? Run to God. This is what happens in times of struggles. When there's things that we can't do, run to God. That's all you have to do. Run to God. Take a look at verse 4. He said, "You have given a banner to those who fear you, that it may be displayed because of the truth, Selah, that your beloved may be delivered, saved with your right hand, and hear me." So we see that here he says, I know what you've done, Lord, with all this that I'm questioning. You've cast us off. You've broken us down. You've been displeased. I know you have power, but what you're doing is this. You're stopping me from doing this, and you're causing me to now run back to you. You've given a banner to those who fear you. You've given a rally point. I'm coming back to you now, that it may be displayed because of the truth. The truth is what? Don't trust in man. Don't believe in what you can do. Trust only in God. And he says that, as he goes on to say, that your beloved may be delivered, saved with your right hand and hear me. So he says, only you can deliver. Only you can do these things. And so as he recognizes that God had allowed this, now we begin to see that, yeah, David sees the setback as a spiritual correction, but the correction is what? Just don't trust in man, but now run to God. Run to God. And so keep in mind that David is going to actually have a victory, but not like he imagined it. Now the victory is not going to be David and his cunning. Now the victory is not going to be David and what he's doing, because he's already said, you've cast us down, you've broken us down, you've been displeased. I want to take you to a passage found in Exodus chapter 17. In Exodus chapter 17, dealing with a banner, what I'm going to do is this. I'm going to read verse 15, and then I'm going to start all the way back to verse 8. But in verse 15, it makes a statement. Moses built an altar and called its name, "The Lord is my banner." Jehovah Nissi. Yahweh Nissi. You're my banner. You're my rallying point. Now, look at what happens within this context to why he says, God, you are my rallying point. It begins this in verse 8 of Exodus 17. Now, Amalek came and he fought with Israel in Rephidim. And Moses said to Joshua, choose some men and go out and fight with Amalek. And tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with a rod of God in my hand. So Joshua did as Moses said to him. He fought with Amalek, and Moses and Aaron and Hur went up to the top of the hill. And so it was when Moses held up his hand, intercession, that Israel prevailed. And when he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands became heavy. So they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and the other on the other side, and his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. So Joshua defeated Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. And the Lord said to Moses, write this for a memorial in the book and recount it in the hearing of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. He says, you have to write this down, show Joshua, because see, Joshua just thought what? I'm winning, I'm losing, I'm winning, I'm losing. But the reality was what? Intercession, no intercession, intercession, no intercession. It's spiritual. The battle is the Lord's. And so it says, and Moses built an altar and called his name, the Lord is my banner. So keep in mind that as we're seeing this, David initially recognizes I'm being chastised by God. Something's going on. So I'm going to run to God. That's the whole thing. This is where the God brings struggles in our lives to cause us just to run to him, leave everything else behind. Now in verse 6 through 8, it says here that David begins to prophetically declare that not only is... that Israel belongs to God, but all nations belong to God. Take a look at verses 6 through 8. God has spoken in his holiness, I will rejoice, I will divide Shechem. Okay, so he talks about, I'm going to divide Shechem, which is inside Israel. I will measure out the valley of Succoth inside Israel. Gilead inside Israel is mine. Manasseh inside Israel is mine. Ephraim is the helmet for my head. Judah is my lawgiver. So he begins to talk about north, south, east, and west, these cities in Israel. And he says this, they're all mine. They're all mine. And he says, Judah is my lawgiver, and then Moab is my washpot. So not only does he say that I'm in control of everything within Israel, but he also says I'm in control with what? Everything outside of Israel. And it's important to recognize that God is concerned with what? What you are in right now, but also what you'll be facing. He's in charge of it all. So he says, Moab is my washpot. Over Edom I will cast my shoe. Philistia shall shout in triumph because of me. Here we begin to see that God does this amazing thing, that the nations are subject to God, not to David. It's important to note that. It's important to recognize that when it comes to the reality here, that this is what David begins to see. You are in control of everything. And then in verse 9, he makes a statement, and I think it's so important to recognize that in verses 9 and 10, he says, what can I do if you are not with me? Read it with me. Who will bring me into the strong city? Who will lead me to Edom? Is it not you, O God, who cast us off? And you, O God, who did not go out with our armies? He says, listen, I want to recognize that, listen, if you're not doing this, I can't do it. So I love the heart. He says, who's going to bring me in? Who's going to be the one to lead me to Edom? Who's going to be the one to give this victory? And he goes, it has to be you, God, but you've already cast us off. So how does this work? If I come to you, will you move? You understand? When I let go of my pride and let go of everything, and I come and I put my trust only in you, are you going to hear? And I think it's so important that, God, if you're not there, it can't be done. If you're not there, there is no hope. There's a passage that I want you to be aware of, it found in Exodus chapter 33. I want to read to you the first four verses. I'm going to jump all the way down to verse 14 through 16. But in Exodus chapter 33, the first four verses, this is what begins to happen. As we see here, you know, Israel is in sin, and it makes this statement. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Depart and go up from there, you and the people whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt, to the land which I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, to your descendants, I will give it." So I told you I'd give you the land. Verse 2, "And I will send my angel before you, and I will drive out the Canaanite, the Amorite, the Amorite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite. Go up to a land flowing with milk and honey." And he says this, "For I will not go up in your midst, lest I consume you on the way. For you are a stiff-necked people." Now it's amazing. God says, listen, in your sin, I'm still going to give you the land. Because I made a promise to your father. Made a promise to Abraham. And I'm going to give you that land. The angel's going to be before, and you're going to have that land. But I'm not going to be there. You're going to be there without me. So enjoy the land. And then notice what happened in verse 4. When the people heard this bad news, they mourned. And no one put on his ornaments. And so we recognize here there was this mourning going on because God says, listen, you can have all this, but I'm not going with you. And now in verse 14 through 16, it says this. Moses begins to intercede with God. And now he says in verse 14, where God says, "My presence will go with you and I will give you rest." So finally, God relents to say, all right, I'll go with you. Even though these are stiff-necked people, I will go with you. And so in verse 15, he said to them, "If your presence does not go with us, do not bring us up from here. For how will it be known that your people and I have found grace in your sight except that you go with us?" And I think it's so important that it's God's presence that brings the grace. People just, they want, "I want the blessing, I want the blessing." Listen, I don't want anything unless I have you. And this is what David is learning here within this psalm. I don't need the army. I don't need the victory. I need you. And if I have you, all these other things will be fine. Seek first the kingdom and his righteousness. All these other things will be added. And so what happens in verses 11 and 12, David comes back to that powerful truth. The truth that he comes back to a complete reliance on God and no longer man. Because this is what he says in verse 11. "Give us help from trouble. For the help of man is useless. Through God we will do valiantly, for it is he who shall tread down our enemies." Do you understand that this is the beginning of this theology of this cycle of struggles? Initially, what we see is this: God allows a struggle in our life. He allows us to struggle so that you run to God. That's the key. Run to God. And then the next thing is this. Now, once you start running to God, the next step in the cycle of struggles is that struggles can do what? Sometimes as you're going through them, they make you feel distant from God. You ever recognize that sometimes when you're in sin, like, I just don't feel your presence. I don't feel your Holy Spirit. I don't feel your closeness. Why? Because I'm choosing to walk away from you. I'm choosing to walk in a sin. And so we feel this distance. And struggles can make us feel distant from God. Struggles can make us feel vulnerable, thinking what? I have no power. And this is going to have victory over me, and I have no power. And that's what the struggle is. When you begin to seek other things besides God, he shows you what? Their impotence. That's why he said in verse 11, "The help of man is useless." And I'll be honest, the help of everything is useless outside of what? Outside of God. It's only God. That's who we seek after. Now we see here in Psalm 61, he begins by doing this. He begins to say, listen, when I do feel like I'm distant, when I do feel like I'm vulnerable, what I'm going to do is this. I'm going to run to a place of power, security, and protection. He says in Psalm 61 to the chief musician of string instrument, a psalm of David, "Hear my cry, O Lord, attend unto my prayer. From the end of the earth, I will cry to you. When my heart is overwhelmed, lead me to the rock that is higher than I. So understand that when my heart is overwhelmed, we recognize here that David is expressing a desperation. He's expressing an urgency. This is what overwhelmed mean. The very first time that the term overwhelmed is used in the Psalms, I want to read it to you so that you can kind of understand a little bit what David is facing. In Psalm 55, verse 4, first time the term is used in the Psalm, he says this, "My heart is severely pained within me." Now remember, this is that one psalm where we recognize it, that here it is, was the seed of evil, how evil makes us believe lies. "My heart is severely pained within me, and the terrors of death have fallen upon me." And so we recognize that this is where we begin to see, "And fearfulness and trembling have come upon me, and horror has overwhelmed me." This is what happens when we're overwhelmed. Everything is what? Everything is a desperation. Everything is an urgency. Everything is what? I'm drowning here, Lord. And when you're at that place of being overwhelmed, not just a little scared, but literally terrified. You are, it's like basically standing on, you know, a shore and having a tsunami come and just slam you. There's no hope. You're overwhelmed in this area. And so when he's overwhelmed, what happens is this. In verse 3 and 4, he talks about two things. There's a past protection equals a present trust. Take a look at verse 3 and 4. "For you have been a shelter for me." You have been a shelter for me, a strong tower from the enemy. Now he says this, from being that past protection, I'm going to have this present trust. He says in verse 4, "I will abide in your tabernacle forever. I will trust in the shelter of your wings, Selah." So in your tabernacle, where your house is, I'm going to be there. Under your wings, underneath your security, I'm going to trust. And so it's so important where he recognizes you have been a shelter. And guess what? And I'm going to run to you and you'll be a shelter again. See, this is where the past power of God comes into a present trust of God. Because what? He's the same yesterday, for today, and forever. So what's the difference? The difference isn't God. The difference is me. The difference is I'm kind of like I'm wanting God, but not surrendering to God. And now he says this, when you're overwhelmed, you do what? I don't want anything but God. That's all I want. And so we recognize he now goes to verse 5, where this is assurance of the promises of the protection promote this beautiful prayer. He says this, "For you, O God, have heard my vows. You have given me the heritage of those who fear your name. You will prolong the king's life, his years as many generations. He shall abide before God forever. Oh, prepare mercy and truth which may preserve him. So I will sing praise to your name forever, that I may daily perform my vows." Understand that what he's doing, he's making the statement that basically in verse 5, he says, "Listen, I have confidence of one thing. You hear my prayers. For you, O God, have heard my vows. You've given me the heritage of those who fear your name." I've received this blessing. I received the gifts of that inheritance of all those who are yours. I have this. And so once I have this confidence that you've heard, then in verse 6 and 7, what? Then you prolong my life. And then you say what? That you shall abide before God forever. I'm going to be in your presence. Then verse 7, prepare the mercy and the truth which may preserve him. You are going to do what? You're going to preserve me, not because of what I've done, but simply because of who you are and because I'm trusting you. And it's almost as if where Abraham did what? He believed the Lord, and that was accounted him for righteous. It wasn't the works that he did. It was simply the belief. And all you do is what? You trust in God. You trust in God. You trust in God. And so when you're in this area and you see that he's prolonging your life and preparing you with this mercy and grace and preserving you, then what happens is this, verse 8, praise. Praise. "So I will sing praise to your name forever, that I may daily perform my vows." You understand? Prayer and performance. I'm going to do this in my life. I'm going to try to say, what can I do that tells you that I'm grateful? How can I show you that I'm grateful? walk away from you? No, no, to walk towards you, to stay close to you. This has always been as hard as what? A relationship. But so often we think what? Well, we're going to go out, we're going to battle the way we battle because I'm all tough. I can do these things. And then he says what? No, you can't. Not if I don't do it. You're not going to win. Only if I'm here. And so we recognize that once God chastens us, we run back to God. And after we run back to God, then we begin to say, okay, listen, in this time of struggle, my soul is going to just cry out to you. Nothing else. I'm just going to look to you, cry out to you. And then what happens is this. In Psalm 62, we see that this is that solo satisfaction of his shelter, where he says again and again, only God, only God, only God, and God alone. Let me read this to you. And I want to take the first couple of verses because we see that initially what happens is this, that there's this quiet, settled, singular focus and trust in God alone. Let me read it to you. He says, truly, my soul waits for God. From him comes my salvation. He only is my rock and my salvation. He is my defense. I shall not be greatly moved. Do you understand how right now he has this silent meditation where he says, my soul silently waits. I'm not yelling, I'm not screaming, but I do know this. I do know that it's only you. Do you understand? You come to this point where we're after you begin to seek and you begin to have the supplication that now that you're with God, you want nothing else. I only want nearness with you, only you, you alone, nothing else added, just you. And I'm not looking for all the things that you can do. I'm not looking for all the things that you can give. I just want you. You know what happens when you seek God? All these other things shall be added. But we're after all these other things because we're not really doing what? We're not really making God the singular focus. We're not making God the singular trust. And this is what David does. He says, he only is my rock and my salvation. He is my defense. And because of that, I shall not be greatly moved. So as we look to this, we begin to see that this is his heart. Now, in verse 3 and 4, we begin to recognize that there is an area in need of help of this human opposition that David is facing. And as he's facing this, keep in mind that his enemies are going to see David as vulnerable because his enemies don't know something that David knows. See, the enemies think that they're battling David. They're not. The battle's the Lord's. So take a look at verse 3 and 4 and see how the enemies really don't understand the scope of the battle. He says this, how long will you attack a man? You shall be slain, all of you. Like a leaning wall and a tottering fence, they only consult to cast him down from his high position. They delight in lies. They bless with their mouths, but they curse inwardly. Do you understand how they really begin to say, David, you're vulnerable. They're going to say in verse 4, they only consult to cast him down from his high position. You are going to not be in a position of leadership. We are going to wipe you out. And what happens is this. When they begin to try to say, listen, we have power over you. What does David do? Once again, take a look at verses 5 through 7. He comes back to what? A quiet, settled, singular focus on God and trust in God alone. Look at verse 5. Again, my soul waits silently for God alone, for my expectation is from him. He only is my rock and my salvation. He is my defense. Do you understand again what he's saying? My soul, verse 5, silent does what? For God alone. Singular focus. Nothing else but God, just him. For my expectation is from him. My hope is only from God. He alone, he only is my rock and my salvation. You want to have nothing else, only God. And that's the only thing I'm focused on is just him and him alone. And he says this, he alone, he only is my rock and my salvation. He is my defense. I shall not be moved. In God is my salvation and my glory, the rock of my strength, and my refuge is in God. Do you recognize how over and over again what he begins to point out is simply this? It's this quiet, settled, singular focus on God. That's what we call the solo satisfaction of his shelter. Now, in verse 8, he makes this statement, and I think it's so important when it comes to recognizing within this cycle of the struggles, how we sometimes step out thinking we can do things. God puts a struggle and say, nope, only I do things. So you come back to him and you rely on him and you recognize I'm overwhelmed. I can only trust in you. We come into this place where now it's just waiting on him. But in verse 8, he makes this statement. Note this, underline it, highlight it, do something with it. Trust in him at all times, you people. Pour out your heart before him. God is a refuge for us. It's so important to recognize, empty what little you have, empty what little you are, and pour it out to God. Just do that with whatever you have. If you're like, I don't have much, he doesn't need much. You understand? He doesn't need a lot. He needs what? Well, first of all, he tells you to be humble, not haughty. And so you have to become little. You know, keep in mind that when we initially saw Paul the Apostle, he wasn't Paul the Apostle. He was Saul of Tarsus. Saul in the Greek means what? Same thing in the Hebrew, sought after. Paul means what? Little. You know what I mean? He wasn't, I'm just a little thing, but I can give a little to God. And when I give a little to God, what can God do with what? Next to nothing. Now, on Sunday, we looked at this passage, and I want you just to be aware of it. I'm just going to make a reference to it. But we looked at Acts chapter 7, verses 20 through verse 36. This is where Stephen talks about Moses and how Moses came on the scene. But initially, it talks about in Acts 7 that for the first 40 years, Moses thought he was somebody. For the next 40 years, God says, listen, and he would have supposed that his brothers would know that he was the deliverer, because I've been trained in all the ways of Egypt. I'm a somebody. God says, no, you're not. You may be a somebody, but I'm not using somebody. So what he does is he takes a somebody, puts him into the back of the desert for 40 more years, shepherding sheep. Now that's something to boast in. Now, I can see boasting in all the wisdom and knowledge of Egypt, but now boasting in the knowledge of what, taking care of sheep for 40 years in the back, not even in by the city, in the backside of a desert. Now, after he becomes nobody, which is 40 years of being a nobody, then God finally says, okay, Moses, guess what? I can use a nobody. And for 40 years, I'm going to have you shepherd these people now. But it has to be what? You have to come up with whatever you have, how little it is, pour it out to God. Remember, if you're familiar with that passage, when initially in Exodus chapter 4, verse 2, when God calls Moses from the burning bush, he says, okay, Moses, I want you to go. He says, well, what do I do? He goes, what's in your hand? I got a rod. That's good enough. We can use that. You don't need anything else. We're going to have this rod make rivers in the blood, part the Red Sea. We can do everything with that. I don't need big. I just need you, obedience, and whatever you have. David would take on Goliath. Remember, initially King Saul said, what? Here's my armor, here's my swords. And they said, yeah, this stuff is really nice for you. It's not for me. But what does David do? He takes on 5 smooth stones. He takes on a sling, and he goes and faces the giant. And there in 1 Samuel 17, verse 40, we begin to see that David does what? Whatever he has. He doesn't need a lot to conquer this giant. The giant has everything, spears of weaver's beam, giant swords and armors and armor bearers, but he doesn't have God. And David has what? Man, I know whose battle this is. But the thing is, give God everything that you are, regardless of how little. And that's what verse 8 begins to say. Trust in him at all times, you people. Pour out your heart to him. When it says pour out, it means to gush out. It means to empty out. It means to expend life. To empty everything you are to God. And I think, man, what an amazing thing when you empty everything to God. And then we recognize what? Empty what little you have. And understand that you're not going to have a lot, because you're not a lot. We recognize what? Remember what we said when we were there in Psalm 60, verse 11? He said, for the help of man is useless. What can I do to help God? It's useless. I'm just vanity. And so there's nothing I can do. I'm basically just a vapor. And so we see here, when he says, pour out your heart before God, now we come into verse 9, and we recognize in verse 9 and 10 that there's two things you learn. that both man and what man trusts in is useless. Now, I don't know if you like those verses, but I think it's important to read it anyways. Both man and what man trusts in is useless. It says in verse 9, surely men of low degree are a vapor, and men of high degree are a lie. If they are weighed on the scales, they are altogether lighter than vapor. So you understand that a man who's next to nothing, he says what? You are nothing. And a lot of us, we don't want to hear that. We don't want to hear that we're nothing. Now, of course, we looked on Sunday about what? When we talked about not exalting yourself, but humbling yourself before the Lord, that we saw what? That there are certain people who go to a feast, and what they do is this. They sit in the best places because I should have this place of honor. And eventually, he says, don't do that, because if the guy who put on the feast comes and says, listen, where you're sitting, that was for somebody else. And now you got to take a walk of shame all the way down to the bottom. And he says, go sit at the bottom. And that way, if the guy comes in and says, hey, no, why are you doing in the bottom? Come up front. And you get to, before everybody, do that. But here's the catch. See, there's some people who go and they try to sit in the bottom, knowing with everything they are, the guy's going to come in and move me to the top. And then I sit in the bottom and nothing happens. When are you going to get me? When are you going to move me up? And nothing happens. See, that's the mark of a man. When you're able to sit in the bottom and be content with being the bottom and say, listen, come up, I'm fine right here. This is good. But what happens is, and I think it's so important, we see surely men of low degree are a vapor. Have you ever been in the wintertime and you blow out and all of a sudden you see this little vapor and then it's gone. It's just here. And the vapor is nothing. It has no substance. It doesn't knock down trees. It doesn't do anything. It's just there and it's gone. He says, men of low degree are vapor, but men of high degree are a lie. That's incredible. Is it men of high degree? They're an illusion. They're not true. Do you understand? Men of low degree are nothing. Men of high degree, what? It's false. They're a lie. It's an illusion. No man is anything. And it says here, they are lighter. They are altogether lighter than vapor. If they're weighed on the scales, they're literally nothing. So understand that men are nothing. And then he goes on to say this, not only are men nothing, but when what men trust in is also nothing. He says, do not trust in oppression, nor vainly hope in robbery. If riches increase, do not set your heart on them. When he talks about the wealth, he says this, some people do everything they can to get wealth, even if it's by questionable means. And he says, don't try to pursue wealth thinking that that's going to help you. Don't try to pursue wealth thinking that that's going to benefit you. And then the next thing he says is this, if you have riches that are increased in the right way, don't trust in those either. So understand that everything that men trust in, everything that men wants, he says, listen, if I have to do through hook and crook to grab it, he says, don't trust in that. But if your riches increase, don't set your heart on those either. Don't put your heart and trust in men or what men rely on. Why? In verse 11, he says this. There's only one thing to trust in. One thing only to trust in. There's only one power to trust in, and that's God. In verse 11 and 12, he says this. God has spoken once. Twice I have heard this, that power belongs to God. Also you, O Lord, also to you, O Lord, belongs mercy, for you render to each according to his work. And I love this heart because we begin to see that, listen, it's only about what? It's only about what God is doing. It's only about what God has accomplished. And so recognize there's a whole thing about this solo satisfaction is, God, I just want you. I just want you. I just want you. Because you've spoken it, and I've heard this, that what? It's you. Power belongs to you. Also to you, O Lord, belongs mercy. So you have what? You have authority, and you have what? You have the ability to not give me what I deserve, for you rendered each one according to his work. You're going to give the rewards that are right. And now we see in Psalm 63, we begin to see here that there's this savor of this spiritual satisfaction, that when you come and you get to the point that it's only God, if you get to the point in your relationship where all you want is just a closer relationship with God, I want to read the word and I want to see God. Do you understand that so many people want to read the word so this can be fixed, and I want to read the word so that can be fixed, and you want to read the word so that I have power and I have a new position, And we try to do that, and you read the scriptures and thinking that you have life, but they are they that testify of him, and he's alive. But you come to the point where all of a sudden nothing matters but God. And when you come to that place of nothing matters but God, then you recognize what? Man, I am satisfied, and I don't want anything but God. So take a look here at the Psalm 63. It says this is the Psalm of David when he was in the wilderness of Judah. And again, that header means something. And as he says he's in the wilderness of Judah, you have to understand that what we see is this. He doesn't have the temple. He doesn't have Jerusalem. He doesn't have his palace. He doesn't have his throne. He has nothing. Everything that he would want, everything that would bring him some kind of comfort of what he used to have a palace, he used to have a throne, he used to have Jerusalem where it was a city, he used to have the temple he could go to, and now he says this, he's in the wilderness. Now notice what happens when he's in the wilderness. He says, God, you are my God, and early will I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh longs for you in a dry and thirsty land where there is no water. So I have looked for you in the sanctuary to see your power and your glory. Because your loving kindness is better than life, my lips shall praise you. Thus I will bless you while I live. I will lift up my hands in your name. It's amazing as we begin to see here, initially, he's just doing one thing. He's seeking God's presence. Now, notice what he's trying to do. He's in the wilderness, and he doesn't want these things that are reminders of God. He actually wants the physical presence of God. I want to witness you. My soul thirsts for you. I'm longing for you. I have this deep, deep spiritual need just for you, and I'm just longing for you. I'm thirsting for you. My soul thirsts. My flesh longs. Everything just wants you. As we begin to do so, this longing is so intense that the body begins to feel its effects. It's amazing when people first say, wow, I'm in love. Changes your whole body. You can't sleep, you can't eat, you can't all these things. And then what happens? Well, eventually, love wears off and I'm not so much in love anymore. I go back to eating. I go back to doing things. But when God begins to do what you long for to such a degree that everything in your body begins to change, he says, my soul thirsts for you. My flesh longs for you. And then he goes on to say this. Through that now, he's seeking a physical presence, a physical closeness with God. And he says in verse 2, so I've looked for you in the sanctuary to see your power and your glory. I want to see you. But not only does he want God's physical presence, but take a look at verse 3 and 4. He also wants to experience God's love. Not only do I want your physical presence, I want emotional closeness. And I want spiritual closeness. I want the physical closeness. Yes, my soul thirsts for you. My flesh longs for you. But also, I want to experience your love and these emotions. So he says this, because your loving kindness is better than life. Do you understand? I want your loving kindness. I want your love. I want that emotion. I want that spirit. My lips shall praise you. Thus I will bless you while I live, and I will lift up my hands in your name. Amazing how we say this is what begins. I want to experience you physically, emotionally, and spiritually. And then what happens is this. When you have that presence, that closeness of God that you long for, that you're craving, that your soul is thirsting for, now we see in verse 5 and 6 that what? You have this incredible satisfaction because of that closeness. It says this, my soul shall be satisfied. That's with marrow and fatness, and my mouth shall praise you with joyful lips. It's amazing that he has this incredible satisfaction now because of this closeness. Now that you're here and I've experienced you physically, I've experienced you emotionally and spiritually, all these things, I'm getting close to you. Now my soul is satisfied. He says, almost as what? The marrow and the fatness. What does that mean? Have you ever eaten a steak that doesn't have a lot of marble in it, and then you've eaten a steak that has a lot of marble in it? See, if you have a steak that has marbling in it, it's so good and it's so juicy. Why? Fat. And then you have what? That whole area where if you cut that bone, the marrow itself begins to just seep out and you've got this richness of flavor. That's what I want. So my soul will be satisfied as what? As if I'm eating this amazing steak. Now, a man knows meat. You know, that's you understand that, what he's talking about here. And then he says this, and my mouth shall praise you with joyful lips. So as he moves on from there now in verses 7 through 11, we begin to see that what? There's a security that comes from closeness. Take a look at verse 7. He says, because you have been my help, therefore in the shadow of your wings I will rejoice. Do you understand the security comes from being close? And in verse 7, he talks about what? I'm under the shadow of your wings. Do you know where, how close you have to be to a bird to be under the shadow of the wings? Right next to the bird. You got to be right next to God to be under the shadows. It's because of this closeness. Guess what I have? I have this incredible peace. I have this incredible security. And then in verse 8, it says this. Not only do you have to start close, but then he says this, stay close. You understand? He says, my soul follows close behind you. Your right hand upholds me. So first you have to get close, and then you have to stay close. See, what happens is when you begin to follow at a distance, I don't know if you're familiar with that passage where eventually we'll get there on Sundays in Mark 14, verse 54, that Peter followed at a distance. And what happened with that? Well, he denied the Lord three times. He wasn't there close. It was, I want to be close. I want to kind of see, but I'm going to be way back here. And what happens, you don't have that closeness. You don't have that security. Peter didn't have that security. When people tested and said, who are you? Remember when he was with the Lord, he had enough, you know, gumption to do what? Slice off Malchus's ear. He said, hey, let's go to war. And God said, no, put away your sword, Peter. We're not doing that now. And so when he's close by, there's bravery. Now that he's further away, he doesn't. And I think it's so important that you start close. There be in the shadow of his wings, and this is where security is. Security comes from closeness. You start close, and you have to stay close. My soul follows close behind you. And then what happens is this. When you recognize that I'm close, verse 9 makes this declaration, 9 and 10. But to those who seek my life to destroy it shall go to the lower parts of the earth. They shall fall by the sword. They shall be a portion. They shall be a portion for jackals. When you are close to God, when people decide to battle you, guess what? They're not battling you. God just says, hey, stay here. I'll take care of this. You don't have to go out in front of me. I'm good. But see, when you're not close to God, then what do I do in this battle? But when I'm close to God, he does what? Just stay here, son. We're good. I'll take care of this. And this is what they don't understand, is that when you are there close to God, those who seek my life to destroy it, they're just going to go down to lower pits there because they're thinking they're fighting against me, but they're not. They're fighting against God because I'm close to him. And it's so important that as I'm close to you, they don't battle me, they battle you. And then in verse 11, I love this because he talks about this exposed speech. There are those who do what? He says, I'm going to expose your speech. Two kinds of people. He says, but the king shall rejoice in God. Everyone who swears by him, the one thing, saying, I belong to him, I swear allegiance to him, shall glory, but the mouth of those who speak lies shall be stopped. It's important to know that God is going to expose the speech. Why? Some people make certain statements with their mouth, but their heart is far from it. They say, I'm going to do this, and I want to do this, but there's like, okay, I'm saying I want to do this, but that's just my mouth, because my heart wants to do something else. There's an amazing thing in the book of Romans, in chapter 12, it teaches us two incredible things. One, you just give yourself over to God as a living sacrifice, that you surrender your body to God. But the other thing he does is this. He makes a statement that as you give yourself over to God, that what begins to happen is this. He says, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good, acceptable, and perfect will of God. We see here that one of the things that Romans 12:2 teaches us is your mind has to be renewed. Why? Because your body is always going to do what it desires. Your body is always going to follow my desires. Because I'll tell you what, My heart is strong. My desires are strong. And then when I say this, I'm not going to desire it. I'm not going to desire it. I'm not going to desire it. Well, guess what I'm doing? I'm planting the seed. Every time I say, I'm not going to desire this, I now plant it. I don't have it. I want it. But I'm not going to desire it. And I say it again. Do you understand that every time you say you're not going to say it and you say it, then you think it. If you say, I'm not going to think about elephants. Now, none of you came in thinking about elephants, but now all of you are thinking about elephants. And I say, no, look, don't think about elephants. I just said it again. And now you're, oh, well, what else? You keep saying don't think. You keep saying it, and I keep hearing it, and I keep thinking it. That's what we do with God. We say, I don't want this. I don't want this. And he says, this is what begins to happen. When you constantly come into that thing and say, listen, if you recognize what Romans 12 begins to do, he says, you have to renew your mind. You have to literally do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing. Because when you change your mind spiritually, then your desires are going to change. And you can't change your desires of your heart until you change the desires of your mind. And that's why God says, renew your mind. Change your mind. Don't let this be the focal point. Let God be your focal point. Just focus on him. Not doing this, but just drawing near to him. And when you do this, he becomes the focal point. Then you renew your mind. And guess what? He becomes your desires. The spiritual becomes your desires. And then guess what? The sin falls away. Because you are that one slave to what? Who you choose to obey. Who I give myself over to. Who I talk to. Who I say. And even if I say, I don't want to speak of elephants. I don't want to think of elephants. When you say it, you go there again and again. And you're planting a seed and you're feeding it to your flesh. You have to change your desires. Once your mind is changed, your desires change. Once your desires change, guess what? Your body changes. But it has to be in that thing. And this is why he says, listen, you got to swear by him. You got to speak him. Only him. Focus on him. And he says this, but the mouth of him who speaks lies shall be stopped. When you say it's other things, guess what? You say, God, it's you. No, this is what you're focused on. God, it's you. No, this is what you love. God, this is you. And it's a lie. And he says, listen, if that's the case, you're not going to have victory. You're not going to have anything that you need when it comes to that. And then lastly, we see this. As he exposes the speech of those who swear by him, they have glory and they shall continue. Those who lie, they're going to simply be stopped. And then lastly, in verse 64, or chapter 64 of the Psalms, we see the secured victory. Now, this psalm is split into two sections. You have one, the plots, and you have the weapons. And so you have, basically, you have the plots and you have the protection. This is what we're looking at. So when you're looking at the two sections, verses 1 through 6 are the plots. Verses 7 through 10 are the protection. Now what happens is this, in this whole issue of the cycle of struggling, that once God becomes everything, you just savor him and you love him and you seek him and you surrender to him. He becomes everything. Once your soul thirsts for him in that way that, man, like I'm a man in the desert that just needs some water. That's how much I want you. I need the life that is in you. Now what happens is this. When you are in that way, now we begin to see here that God will always secure your victory. He'll always secure the victory. When you long for him in such a way, there's no doubt that he's going to hear you, no doubt that you're only focused on him, and that when you're focused on him, you're going to have a renewed mind. The renewed mind is going to change your desires, and your changed desires are going to change your life. But he says this, and I want you to take a look at here, Psalm 64, when we first look at these plots that are here. You've got two things that you look at here. And initially, you begin to see the plots or the scheming, and then we begin to see the weapons that they scheme with. Take a look at the first two verses. Hear my voice, O God, in my meditation. Preserve my life from fear of the enemy. Hide me from the secret plots of the wicked, from the rebellion of the workers of iniquity. Do you understand that what he's saying is this, that there are plots and there are schemings. There is this whole issue where people are scheming, people are plotting, and they want my downfall. And then we begin to see this, and this is where the hook is. And I think what an amazing thing that David begins to recognize in this area of where the secured victory really is. What is the greatest weapon? Take a look. It's words. It's slander. Take a look at verse 3. When he talks about, they hide me from the secret plots of the wicked, from the rebellion of the workers of iniquity. Verse 3, who sharpens their tongue like a sword and bend their bows to shoot their arrows, bitter words, that they may shoot in secret at the blameless. Suddenly they shoot at him and do not fear. They encourage themselves in an evil manner. They talk, lying of snares secretly. And they say, who will see them? They devise iniquities. We have perfected a shrewd scheme, both in inward thought and the heart of man are deep. You understand, he talks about this incredible, the weapons that are there. And the weapons that are there are most brutal because what? You have these secret plottings and they use words to destroy. And I'll tell you what, how many people use words to destroy? That you can't do it, you don't understand it, you're this, you're that. The enemy makes accusations all the time, but we've overcome him by what? The blood of the Lamb, and by what? The power of a testimony. This is where the victory is. It's about his work and us surrendering to him, us recognizing by grace you've done this. But understand that the plots they have that came were, the weapons were words. The weapons were slander. They bent their bows at the end of verse 3. Who sharpened their tongue like a sword, they bent their bows to shoot their arrows. Bitter words. Do you understand? In verse 5, they encourage themselves in evil manner. They talk and they of lying snares secretly. They devise, it's just plotting to say, how can we tear you down? How can we make people see you in a way that we want them to see you versus how God sees you? And then we see here the protection. I love what happens in verse 7 and verse 8 because he says this, their own weapons will be their downfall. Take a look at verse 7 and 8. But God shall shoot at them with an arrow. Suddenly they shall be wounded. Now notice verse 8. So he will make them stumble over their own tongue. Do you understand? Their words, what they are trying to do, as they begin to recognize here, The weapons that they try to tear me down will become their own destruction. And I love that about God because you're going to be the great equalizer. And so we see here, he says, okay, and so verse 8, he'll make them stumble over their own tongue. All who see them shall flee away, and all men shall fear and declare the work of God, for they shall wisely consider his doing. It's amazing as we begin to look at this. Now we see this public recognition of God's greatness. It's almost a celebration. So see, when they try to destroy you and plot evil and they try to use words to try to destroy your character, and as they try to do that, what happens is God says, listen, I'm going to destroy your character. I'm going to let everyone know that you're a liar. I'm going to let everyone know that you're a deceiver. I'm going to let everyone know that you know, when we have that tendency of what we have a tendency of doing, I need to deal with the speck in your eye, and I'm not dealing with the plank in my own. You first deal with the plank in your own eye, then you see clearly deal with the speck in your brother's eye. But what happens is we are what? We're speck chasers. And we begin to say, you need to do this, and you haven't done this. And so when that happens, I love the fact because we see here where there's a celebration of what God is doing in verse 9. All men shall fear and shall declare the work of God, for they shall wisely consider his doing. They're going to say, man, I'm going to follow God. I'm going to trust in God. And as we see this public recognition of God's greatness, and then in verse 10 it says this, the righteous shall be glad in the Lord and trust in him, and all the upright in heart shall glory. Do you understand this? This massive celebration. So keep in mind that what we see is this, and now I'm going to give to you the two bookends of what we looked at. Initially there in Psalm 60, remember what was happened, that David was at a war with Mesopotamia and Syria. This is a national crisis, national crisis. He goes through all these emotions, some nationally, most himself, but then at the very end of Psalm 64, verse 10, it's national again. The righteous shall be glad in the Lord and trust in him, and the upright in heart shall glory. You understand that once again, nationally, God, you're being seen and you're victorious. And so everyone is just recognizing who you are. So I think it's just so important to see that when we go through these psalms in their groupings, as we look to them in their areas of theology, where, you know, tonight we looked at the theology of the cycles of struggles. Keep in mind, each psalm is independent. Each psalm is amazing in itself. But when you begin to look at a theology, you see this theology builds and then is built upon and built upon and built upon, where you understand the concept of struggles. You understand sometimes God allows struggles to do what? Bring us back to Him. Bring us back to Him. As He brings us back to Him, then when we seek Him, we begin to say, God, it's only You and You alone am I seeking, and I want to recognize You and worship You and trust in You, and only in I trust in You. And so hear my prayer, attend unto my cry. When my heart is overwhelmed, I'm going to come to You. That's what God always wanted. You left me. Now I'm giving You these struggles. You come back to me. But now that You're back to me, do what? Recognizing that now that I sought You, now that I'm overwhelmed and I come to You, I realize what? Only You. God alone, God alone, God alone, nothing else but You. And when I get to that place, then what? Now I'm satisfied in You alone. Man, why did I want these other things? Because You are everything. And so I recognize You are my God. My soul thirsts for You. My flesh longs for You. I only wanted You. And then what does He do? He says, now that You have me, victory. When we come to this place of recognizing that these cycles of struggles will hit every one of us at some time. And the answer is found in what? The heart of David, as he led by the Spirit to just take psalm upon psalm upon psalm and build on this beautiful theological truth. Father, we thank You for this word. We thank You for Your grace. We thank You for just who You are and how You work. And we're asking God that through Your Spirit and through Your ministry that You would continue to bring us to this place of trusting in You. Bring us to this place of only relying on You and surrendering to You. That God, we would come to this place recognizing that certain times we will have struggles. And we'll have struggles because we've taken our eyes off You and we're trying to trust other things and You're trying to show us these things will not help You. These things are vanity. These things are empty. Don't put Your trust in man. Don't put Your trust in what man trusts. Trust in Me alone. And we come back to You and then we long for You and we worship You. We're satisfied in You. And then all these things come to us. We seek first You and the kingdom. And amazingly, as Your word declares, all these things are added. So continue to do this work within our hearts. We ask it in Jesus' name. And all saints of God said, amen.